So I'm Rick Hansen. This is the San Rafael Meditation Group, Wednesday, August 5th, 2009. And welcome, everybody. Thank you, whoever it was, Tressa maybe, brought the munchies. There's apparently some food out there.
There are others who brought.
Oh, thanks to all. If you brought any food or drink, want to raise your hand? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be auctioning that recipe as a fundraiser. That's really good. If this is your first night, welcome. I really enjoy having you here. If you're not on any of my email lists or not on the email list for this sitting group and would like to be, please leave your name and email address printed neatly on the yellow pad back there by the donation basket. And also I encourage you, just as a simple, efficient matter, to, if you're willing to, get a Facebook account, which is really not that hard to do, and then join the San Rafael Meditation Group, where I routinely post little things in the wall. But it's an efficient way for people to see stuff, and you know, it's cool, and you can step out of the whole Facebook tentacles, just San Rafael Meditation. That'll give you what you need. A couple of housekeeping details, if I could. One is just as a general practice, and I'll send out another announcement about it. When we, at a quarter to seven, I'll leave that door ajar, which is to say a few inches wide for airflow and ease of moving in and out. You don't need to seal it tightly, because obviously when it's sealed tightly and people naturally want to open it, it makes a jarring noise. And if you're sitting near it and you notice that someone has either left it wide open or closed it tightly, you can just jiggle it so it's ajar, you know, a couple inches open, and that'll take care of that part. I will also create a handy dandy sign and stick it on the door that says, you know, please leave ajar a couple inches. Okay? So that part's easy. I will bug Asante yet again about the toilet flow problem, and we have an act of extraordinary Donna here, generosity, on your part, right? Because you're going to fix the toilet so it works after a year of me bugging Asante. Thank you. That's right. That's right. That's worth a lot of chocolate chip cookies. Fix that darn toilet so it fills fast. Okay, great. I should add, donation bowl is there. Dark chocolate, bananas, advice, poems are always welcome. Also money. Money helps pay for the rent here and supports me in doing that work. But it's really, truly always about whatever's freely offered, both on my end and your end. Okay, great. Let's see. Our normal practice is to start out by taking a question or a comment about meditation, either in general or tonight or anything. And I'm going to keep my response and maybe the discussion on that fairly short. Then tonight in particular, I want to invite you to do a little practice. And I brought a handout to that effect. And then we'll open it up for a discussion about it. And the little practice is about dealing with people who are upset with you, or, you know, who want something from you, you may not want to give, who are critical, who are, you know, aggravating you, whatever that is. How do we bring practice to that rubber road moment there? Okay? So, first, any questions or comments about meditation in general, you know, your meditation tonight, anything? Yeah, please. Well, let me see if I can say it back, and partly I do that because, as we talked last time, I do post these talks, and as a respect for privacy, I'm, you know, fairly carefully turning my recorder off when you speak, generally speaking.
I don't care if you have your recorder on.
Yeah, but it helps me as a general practice, but you generally. But that said, if I got it right, you're asking first, what is mindfulness, right? And then you're getting into really deep waters about what happens when one is mindfully aware of the present moment in a very stable way. Does that take one into an experience of the eternal? And is there dharma, which is to say teachings from the Buddha, about the eternal, right? Or this matter of the now and present moment awareness, correct? Is that right, more or less, the question?
As much as I know, which is not very much.
Yeah.
I'm just walking around the edges.
Well, I think you're actually fairly deep in the pool, because every time you ask a question or make a comment, it really does tend to come from the deep end. I'm looking over there, seeing some scuba gear, in fact, you know. You're really down there, really pretty deep. That's a compliment, seriously. And by the way, I think we could probably leave the door open, too, unless it's noisy in the hallway. I don't know. It is? Oh, then do what works for you. Oh, yeah, no. Do what works for you. What are they doing out there?
Filling the toilet.
Oh, yeah, keep it closed. Do what you need to do. Really, no worries. Okay, so to the question. So first of all, mindfulness in Buddhism, there are three key words or concepts. One is consciousness. And the Pali word for that you may come across is vijnana. And consciousness in Buddhism, certainly original Buddhism, the Buddha's teachings, is not seen as any particularly special thing. Consciousness is not seen as partaking of divine consciousness in any way, or as anything that is not dependent on conditions. Consciousness is seen to arise at the encounter of a sense organ and a sense object. And one of the sense organs is the mind. And one of the sense objects are mind objects, you know, thoughts and so forth. Okay? Good. So, vijnana. Got consciousness? Now you all understand consciousness, right? No one knows really how it happens, whether in a lizard or a human being, but, you know, vijnana, consciousness. Think of it as just sort of almost like a field. Second, there is what's called mindfulness. The word for that is sati. You may have seen the Sati Center in South San Francisco area, Gilfronstal Center. You may be familiar with the term Satipatthana Sutta. That's the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutta. Sati means the knowing faculty of mind. So, in other words, if we're sitting and our mind's wandering all over the place and we're completely caught up in some little internal simulator movie, right? Some little mini movie of an argument yesterday with somebody, or this kind of desire we have, or our plan for our vacation, or what we're going to do when we get home tonight. Okay, we're conscious. There's plenty of vijnana, but there's not much sati. In other words, we're swept away. We're lost in thought. There's no knowing quality. Okay? Which is a little dualistic. There is the knowing and the known. All right, the known arises in vijnana, arises in consciousness, and is known by the knowing quality. So, early Buddhism does have a fair amount of dualism in it, just sidebar. Okay. Then the other key word is sampajana. What it means is basically kind of like knowledge. There's this knowing faculty, and then there's a sort of minimal, like, that's a zafu, you sit on it, okay, it's purple. Sampajana, you know, basic knowing. So in other words, there you are with the bowl of fruit, and, you know, consciousness is there to receive the impression of the bowl of fruit coming, let's say, through your eyes. Sati, there is this fundamental kind of knowing feeling or quality of this present moment in all its elements, and sampajana is some basic information about that which is known. Okay? So those are quite useful distinctions, really. And what we're trying to do is stabilize the knowing quality of mind, the mindfulness. We're trying to stabilize it and make it more spacious. Those are two key qualities, stability and spaciousness. If you just kind of keep coming back to the stability and spaciousness of your awareness, of the knowing quality, then you're on the right track. Okay? Now, what gets very interesting now to the deeper end of the pool, all right? It is really true that when there is this knowing quality, particularly with a lot of renunciateness in it, in a sense that you're renouncing chasing pleasure, you're renouncing resisting pain. Okay? There's just an even, stable, spacious quality of knowingness. All right? When that happens, it is true that, is it not true, that we all start to experience more of being here now, in the present moment. And in the present moment, we start seeing things arise and pass away very quickly. And as our practice gets, you know, deeper, we start seeing that more and more acutely. Now, in the brain, which is where, in Western science, consciousness occurs. The brain somehow, mysteriously, no one knows how, produces consciousness. Okay? The nervous system, broadly defined, embedded in a larger network of causes in the natural world and so forth. All right. In early Buddhism, the Buddha didn't understand it, but there was basically a notion that, you know, the consciousness arises in the biology. Okay? So what's the nature of consciousness in the human brain in terms of this point about now? Now, if now, think of now as this incredibly thin slice of time. Right? That's what it is. If you know any kind of calculus or something like that, or you dimly recall that, it's like at the limit, you know, of the narrowing, we come to now. And other than right now, nothing exists. We can understand that intellectually, at least. We can look back and go, those things that happened, they're not here anymore. The things that will happen aren't here yet. The only thing that is existent is now, is what's now. And that now is probably vanishingly small at the limit of time. You know, as time, as you break seconds into smaller and smaller pieces and get closer and closer to that edge, that's now. People generally do not understand now in physics. It's really quite remarkable. It's one of the great deep mysteries in physics is time. Like, why doesn't everything just stop? Or how does anything transfer from then to then? Or, you know what I mean? Like, see what I mean? If the now disappears, how does anything get across? It's like, what? And not to get all weirdly cosmic about it, but just to go, holy moly, and have the mystery of it all kind of open our heart. You know, like, kids are very hard open often, I think partly because they're just bamboozled by so many things. Like, what? Wow. Okay. Now, in the brain, though, what's very interesting is that even though now is probably vanishingly small, there seems to be a kind of reverb circuit in the looping of the networks that allows the subject of now to feel like a second or two long. Doesn't it kind of feel like that? And it's like this moving little window, a second or two long, and as it moves, what's at its tail kind of fades and disappears, sort of fades out, you know, and what's at the front fades in and comes into sharp clarity, and it just keeps moving, right? Because there is that reverberation. Even though in reality now is vanishingly small, the brain can preserve the record, if you will, of the last second very easily in a way that it feels existent. So it gives us a sense of continuity. Isn't that kind of interesting? So part of the trick is to not be deluded by that sense of continuity, but to allow the now to be very, very narrow. And the other thing is to, I think, practice increasingly at the leading edge of now. In other words, as things come into being, so for example, as you watch thoughts coming into being in your own mind, when your mind's quiet, you can see that. And as we look out there and kind of intuit or sense the way the universe comes into being at the leading edge of now, at that leading edge, things aren't yet very congealed. They're not yet very stuck. They're not yet unfree. There's a lot of freedom in that emergent edge of now. All right? And Dharma is a lot about freedom. That's why the word is liberation. What is liberation? It's freedom. We become liberated from the causes of suffering. They don't compel us so much. And the more that we kind of hang out in that emergent edge, we have more of a sense of freedom there. And my personal hunch is that people who are very mature in their practice, even enlightened, really that's just kind of where they live. They live right at the emergent edge of now. And that would be consistent with their accounts of what life is like for them. They're not caught in the past, they're not in the future, there's a sense of freedom and spaciousness. Things arise and pass away, but they don't have this gluey, sticky quality to them. Okay? So, in Buddhism, there is an encouragement for very acute present moment awareness as skillful means. Not as an end in itself. Not, in other words, as a way to somehow experience that which is eternal and escape suffering. Because the Buddha said, no, sorry, can't do that. Doesn't work. But to become more and more in the present, it helps us let go increasingly of the past. It helps us not worry so much about the future. And it helps us appreciate how things arise and pass away endlessly. It really takes us to impermanence. You know, the more you hang out in now, the less upset you get by stuff. You see it passes away. It doesn't last. It goes away. And the new thing coming on, you know, toward you, oh boy, you know, you realize it's going to come, it's going to go. It's okay, but you get disenchanted increasingly with what's coming toward you. Right? So you become more and more focused in present moment awareness as a means to an end. What is eternal in Buddhism is the view of the cosmos. It has no beginning, it has no end. The Buddha didn't know about the Big Bang and cosmic microwave background radiation. Didn't know about that stuff. But in Buddhism, it's seen as just eons of world expansion, contraction. Maybe he did know about it. Maybe there are a lot of Big Bangs and then collapses and bangs again or whatever, or multiverses. So in that sense, that's eternal. But there is generally, and the other thing you could say is eternal in the sense that it lasts forever, is complete liberation. In which case there's no more causes to keep coming back. So in that sense, you know, the effect of complete liberation is eternal. But it's not like we're all trying to kind of identify with and something that's eternal. Okay. Later on in Buddhism, Mahayana, they got, you know, Tibetan and Zen and so forth. There is more talk about Buddha nature or the ground as something eternal, right? And more traditional Buddhists have different views about that, including sneering and scoffing and skepticism, because it's seen as a kind of chicken escape, you know, right? As Andy Alinsky, who's a great, great, great authority and teacher of, you know, the early Buddhism, said to me once, he said, you know, hey, the Buddha said basically, there are all these causes, everything's empty, deal with it. Right? That's kind of one way to look at it, too. But it's very interesting that as we deal with it, we get increasingly free of suffering, and we get happier and nicer. Yeah. Okay. So I want to invite you to do a practice, okay? So I have a handout. I printed 30 of these, and then someone needed one of these today for my practice, one of my therapy clients. So I only have 29, so you might have to share. I think we have more than 29 people here, and I probably need one myself. So if you're willing to share a little bit, I could share with you, Diane, a little bit maybe. Okay? So as we're passing these out, I'm going to invite you to do a practice in a moment, which you don't have to do. You never have to do anything I suggest, that's for sure. And in this practice, I'm going to ask you to do a little quick role play that'll last about 5 minutes total, all right? Maybe 6 or 7 total, and then we'll talk about it. And the practice is, I'm going to ask you to pick a partner, spread out a little bit so you have a partner, and then pick an A and a B. A's will go first. Each of you tell your partner some kind of mild to moderate situation you deal with either currently or sometimes it happens for you where someone is upset with you. I'm using the word upset extremely loosely. I mean they maybe are reproachful or they are complaining or critical. You know, there's something bothered them or they want something from you or they feel you let them down or they don't like how you're doing things, or they're, you know, or they're otherwise reactive. Maybe they're just angry or dismissive or, shaming towards you. Whatever it is, right? The sticky stuff of life. Maybe someone's just kind of treating you like a jerk. Okay? At work or something. So tell your partner the situation in, please, about 20 seconds or less. No long narrative about it, no major case about all the things you've tried to do. Just let your partner know enough so that they can, for about 20 seconds, be that way to you. And then, so it becomes a little real for you, all right? So they will say to you something like, your partner will say to you something like, can't you ever put the dishes away right? Right? Or, Mom, I need more money. Or, why don't we ever make love? Ah. Or, why don't you raise the kids the way I do? Or, see what I mean? Whatever's real. Or, why can you never make a meeting on time? Or whatever it is, okay? Like a little bit of a beginning, set you up. And then I'm going to kind of direct you to go through some of these steps, and then we'll talk about it. Oh, then we'll switch roles and talk about it. It's all basically clear? A little ambitious, but I think we can pull it off. All right? So if you're willing to do this, grab a partner and pick an A and a B and spread out. And generally talk softly, if you don't mind. And I'll ring the bells when it's time to listen, okay? Ready? Listen. All right, ready? Okay, good. So I'm going to move us along pretty quickly. So please shush when I ring the little bells. That way we can all hear me and we'll move it along faster. So ready? So A's and B's. So A's, tell your partner the situation. Go. Okay, thank you. That was 20 seconds. All right, good. Bees, tell your partner what the situation is. Begin. Bees. A's told B's what the situation is. Now B's tell A's.
So is he supposed to
repeat
back when he heard from me?
No, no.
Or does he tell his story?
Yeah, he tells his story. Okay, thank you. Okay, now, so each pair should have, or triad, should have one of these sheets at least, all right? And so now, what I'd like you to do, taking about 30 seconds for each one of these major lines here. So 30 seconds for pausing or less, up to 30 seconds, in other words, moving along. Pause. So this is what's going to happen. A's, you're going to be doing this. B's are going to enact the problem. Okay? B's are going to, I'm going to use a direct term here. B's are going to give you some shit. Okay? Right? So B's give A's a little crap for 10, 15 seconds. Just kind of make it a little real. Don't freak them out. Don't yell at them, but give them a little goose. Okay? Got it? So B's are going to do that. Then A's. 0 to, 1 to 30 seconds. Pause. Second, establish mindfulness. You might do this in the first 5 seconds if you're on your ball. Third, center. Come to your center. Find your place of strength. Remind yourself that you don't need to be necessarily implicated by their upset. Remind yourself of your own goodness. Center. Okay. Next, establish your intentions. What are your intentions in this situation or this relationship? Are they to get away from the person as quickly and gracefully as possible? Are they to really try to find out what is the essence of their grievance and deal with it? Is it to, hear them out? What are your intentions? Right? Establish your intentions. Then, applied to both yourself and the other person, find the craving. In other words, first noble truth, recognize the suffering. Okay? That's what I meant to say. Recognize the suffering in them and you. And it's really okay also to be talking this out loud if that helps you. Because you're doing this for yourself. So you're recognizing the suffering in them. You're recognizing the suffering in yourself. You might be naming it. Then find the craving, the clinging, the ignorance in the other person and in you that's driving this upset. What is the craving here of one kind or another? All right? And then we'll stop at that point and come back and discuss it. And then you'll switch roles and then we'll discuss it. Okay? It sounds complicated, but I will give you about 2 to 3 minutes, about 3 minutes total, to go through all of it, A's. Okay? You got it? Anybody have any question about this? Hopefully not. Okay. Ready, B's? Give A some trouble. Begin. Okay, B's, you should be pretty quiet at this point and let A's do their practices now. Listen. Sorry. Okay, A's, if you're not recognizing suffering, if you're not up to that step by now, you should probably get to that step pretty quickly. And we'll take about another minute and a half for the recognizing suffering and recognizing craving. Okay? About another minute and a half. start wrapping it up. Okay. Thank your partner. All right. So quickly, does anyone have any question about the structure of this exercise?
Yeah, a little bit.
It's a little chaotic, but you get the basic idea?
Yeah.
Basic idea, okay. So in a moment now, what's going to happen is you're going to switch roles. And just to recap, what's going to happen is A is going to give you some guff. There we go. That's a little more pleasant word. A is going to give you some guff. And then A's, after 5, 10, 20 seconds, no more, be mostly quiet. And let A's do their practices with you. Okay. Or probably let B's do their practices with you. And then B's, you're going to move through these steps at your own pace, but kind of move yourself along. You can do it completely quietly inside yourself, or you can kind of talk your own process out loud. That's often very useful. It's kind of like mindfulness in the moment out loud of what you're doing as you're trying to practice with this, you know, stream that's just come at you. Got it? And I'll give you a little time check when you for sure should be in the suffering section. Okay? Ready? So how's this work? A's give B's some guff. Begin. You should be at the suffering step by now, more or less.
Thank you.
start wrapping it up. Okay, wrap it up. Come on back. Thank you, partner. Come on back. If there are any stragglers, no stragglers? Good. Okay, great. Come on back. Thank you for putting up with the somewhat improv nature of that. What did you experience? What did you learn? Besides the chaos of the process, but the actual heart of the matter, you know, in terms of this stuff, what did you experience and what did you learn? Jeff?
When I'm caught up in the middle of events, I'm not normally doing any of these things. I'm not mindful. I have no distance from it.
That's a good and, you know, what's a humbling realization, yeah. And how does it go? Or what's the doctor, how's it working for you? When you're not doing this. Okay, not good, huh? Okay, all right, good. Thank you. Okay, yeah, please.
Well, I chose...
Yeah, but, sure, but whatever, whoever, whether it's a police officer stopping you for a ticket, or trying to come in, you know, telling you you're a burglar in your house or something. But whatever the situation is, or if it's your kids, whatever the frameworks are, you know, it could be your doctor, whatever it is. It could be your real lawyer. Bottom line, what are your intentions? And where is the suffering? Where is their suffering? Where is your suffering? What's the first noble truth? There is suffering. First noble truth is not life is suffering, which is routinely how it's translated. It's the truth of dukkha, the dukkha's stress or suffering, the truth of unsatisfactoriness in life. And so we recognize that, right? Right there is really powerful, just to recognize suffering, our own and the other person's. And then second, to get at the second noble truth, which is what's the cause of that suffering, whether we're a parent, whether they are our child or we are their child, right? Where is the clinging? Where is the craving? Whether it's craving to be understood, right? Or craving to have things go our way, or craving to defend ourselves, right? Or craving that they see it our way, right? It's really powerful to do that. Where's the craving? Where's the source? What is sourcing the suffering here? Where's the attachment? Where's the rigidity? With whoever you're with. It's across the board. You know, the Four Noble Truths don't stop at the parent-child relationship or, you know, the police officer traffic ticket recipient relationship. It's a universal collection of truths.
Okay, what I'm saying is there's a craving to see your child emerge into adulthood free of all the problems and
right.
That's
yeah.
That's
well, if I get that right, you're getting at the distinction again in the Dharma between what's called tanha and chanda. It's nice to know these words in a way, but the point is, craving is thirst. Craving is tanha. Craving is I gotta have it. Craving is attachment. I gotta have it. Insistence. Right. Tanha is wholesome desires. I wholesomely want you to get this. You know what I mean? You wholesomely want your children to flourish and thrive. You know, I wholesomely wanted Obama to win. Thank God he did. Whatever it is, there are wholesome desires, right? We wholesomely want people to figure out how to stop heating up the planet or going to war in the Middle East or something. It's okay. So, but there isn't a quality of craving in wholesome desire. That's Wholesome desire is not what's causing this upset. The upset might benefit from more wholesome desires in oneself and hopefully activated in the other person. But wholesome desire does not create suffering. The desire to end suffering is a wholesome desire.
Right? I didn't know about that.
Oh yeah, I know, it's good. And we have a lot of this great stuff. And okay, so other comments or questions? What did you experience? What did you learn about these points? Yeah.
I was really clear because the neurobiology of all of this and the Dharma is fascinating to me. And I realize when confronted with an angry being, my brain instantly mirrors that.
Yeah.
It's just mirroring. And if I can see it, it's just mirroring. Yeah. Likewise, if people yawn, everybody yawns. If people are hugging, people tend to do that. I think we have a tendency to mirror. And if we realize, that's all it is, perhaps, then it's easy to let it go and go to the suggestions.
Great.
And being mindful, being present.
So great.
Am I correct that the brain tends to be wired that way to maybe mirror?
Yeah, we tend to react often with fear. To a threat. We tend to perceive threats. We're primed to see threats. Completely true. And we do tend to emotionally resonate with other people. It is very interesting and curious that... who was it? Was it you, Tarne, last time? Who basically we were talking about how this practice is a very relational practice, mm-hmm. how Sangha, community is not just half the practice. The Buddha told Ananda, it's the whole of the practice, blah, blah. And then was it you, Tarne, who said, well, why is there so much solitude then?
Yeah, right? We go into seclusion.
Yeah, why do we go into seclusion? It was a really great point. And part of it is we go into seclusion to get our act together so we can have healthy relationships that are not crazy, mm-hmm. in other words, right? And so... a lot of the Dharma is about centering yourself and seeing clearly, and then on the basis of that, engaging skillfully. Yeah, and so you don't have to follow these steps in any rigid way, but I just kind of pulled out first what I personally do when I have my act together, and second, what seems to make sense in the Dharma, that you kind of center yourself, and then you approach the Noble Truths in this situation, whatever this one is. Tarne.
I had a thought about this, that it could be thought of as a way to get what you want in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's not a good approach to it. You're probably not going to get what you want in doing this, but you're going to do it in a mindful way that has less stickiness to it, like you're talking about.
Yeah.
You're doing it in a cleaner way, and it may open up some stuff for you that's you need to work on, but it doesn't mean you win.
Right. Well, that's a great one, and let me comment on that, and then let's sit for 1 minute, and then we'll meet again, because the Buddha had this wonderful phrase, I like it a lot, called the happiness visible in this present life. And when you think about wise livelihood, wise speech, wise action, and a lot of commentary he gave about being a happy householder, there is, and then if you observe people, whether they're monks or teachers in a lay tradition, like say Spirit Rock teachers or other people, there is certainly a fair amount of direct assertiveness. I was on the board at Spirit Rock for 9 years, and I saw a fair amount of skillful assertiveness. And if we want to be compassionate to all beings, well, who's the one being we have the most power over? Ourself. We really want to be compassionate to ourselves as well. It's perfectly legitimate to pursue your own chanda, your own wholesome aims, right? And to be with people where we need things from them, we have to work things out, we have reciprocal exchanges, it's important to work things out, to establish some kind of framework of understanding or agreement or accountability, or shrink the relationship to the size that is truly supported by the foundation of it. In other words, if your relationship is this big, but your partner is that trustworthy, that's a problem. You need to either grow their trustworthiness or shrink the scale of the relationship. Otherwise, tons of suffering out here, right? So next time, I really am very interested in getting more and more at this very tricky matter of how do we, in a skillful and effective and dharmically wise way, assert our own needs or negotiate needs with other people without falling into the pitfalls of clinging and suffering, right? That's the trick. But I really think, and it exists also in the Dharma, there's some very good pathways to doing that. If we just knuckled under when people are upset with us and rode out the storm, right, we'd be pretty battered in the process. And I really think there's a place, so I'll give you my personal opinion here from like a long time as a couples counselor and other things. There really is a place for identifying to the maximum reasonable degree what the other person needs and what's legitimate that they're communicating to you, what the correction is to put in. And it doesn't mean you did anything wrong. It's just from now on, okay, what will I do? And then do it. What a practice that is. Be impeccable. Be blameless about it. The bliss of blamelessness, or very close to impeccable about it. And then on the basis of that, ask for what you need and pursue what you need in a serious way. What I see a lot that people do is they live in these poles that are problematic. They both sputter and complain, but they don't drive in a genuine way to what really is legitimately appropriate for them to get. So they're in this horrible place in between. You know what I mean? They're sputtering but ineffectual. Right, they're complaining but ineffectual, and that's a horrible place to be. And so I don't think that's a good place to be, and it's not compassionate for oneself, and it causes a lot of trouble in relationships, and it's unnecessary. There really is a way to be centered, and then on the basis of being centered, being incredibly receptive, and then on the basis of being centered and receptive, to be very strong. You see people doing that all the time. The Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, Thich Nhat Hanh. Thich Nhat Hanh, you know who that is? This, okay. If you don't know, he was a major figure in the Vietnam War. He's a wonderful monk, lives in France mostly, incredibly prolific writer. He was described as a combination cloud, butterfly, and bulldozer. So may you be in this week to come a cloud, a butterfly, and a bulldozer. So let's sit for 1 minute and then we'll end. And next time we'll work through the third and fourth noble truth, more like the good news part, you know, the solutions, okay? So I really invite you to come back. Yeah, take them with you, and I'll print a bunch more too. If you could bring them back, please. Thank you.